Entrou a ventolona.
The beginning of the podcast is starting to look like a long time ago now. We talked to her. What did we talk to her about? We talked about
conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
Don't look up.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a great conversation. Thanks very much to Alenka for joining us. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you want to listen to more, we'll just encourage that you join our Patreon. There's tons of other episodes on there. Discord community. You get to support the podcast, which we would very much appreciate. And should we just roll an interview, fellas?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do it.
All right. See you guys. Bye bye. Yeah, so we wanted to ask you about your essay on Don't Look Up, which the movie that came out a year and a half ago or so, that the three of us really liked. A certain coincidence between conspiracy theories and liberal mainstream hegemonic discourse today. So I wonder if you could speak to that to begin with.
Actually, this is something that I've been working on a lot lately, and if I can use this opportunity to make some publicity, actually, there will be a very tiny book coming out with Polity, which is precisely about this. It focuses on the relationship between disavowal and, let's say, denial, which is what which we associate more directly with conspiracy theories. I try to talk about both and also kind of explain or their relationship. But yeah, already in this article that you mentioned, the argument is simply that the mainstream, which also is a kind of becoming less and less main, so to say, because I think there is something about the mainstream that actually very much needed kind of relatively comfort and vast middle class to really thrive. And this is now kind of disappearing more and more. This is why we see other things coming to the mainstream, which are look more extreme or more. But my thesis is precisely that this mainstream liberal, neoliberal, whatever response to several disasters that we are clearly already facing with, not simply that will strike us in near future, but which are basically already here, that the mainstream response is not that of denial, direct denial, but of disavowal, which has this very precise formula. I know very well, but nevertheless. So the whole point is not simply that you say you know, but you don't really know it. I really think there is something that changes or slightly shifts in this structure of disavowal and produces this first part, this declaration of knowledge, as precisely the kind of fetish that then prevents us or helps us go on with our lives and our business as usual, as if we did not know this. I think that what I very briefly discuss in this article is precisely how this disavowal is as bad as denial, that there is practical consequences are exactly the same. The result is that we do nothing or we do a lot, but in the sense of much ado about nothing, you know, that there is all this commotion. For instance, if you take the climate change, which is also allegedly the object or subject of this movie, you know, that there is all this new speak coming out, green transition, lots of commotion, but we clearly see that at the same time everything goes on as before. There is no big change, particularly not globally talking. And even if some parts of the world outsource the dirty whatever thing to some other countries, it's their dirt, nevertheless, even if they are very green now. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this kind of mainstream liberal business as usual attitude, let's just adapt to things, we can do it, we can manage with some small adjustments, which defines for me really disavowal, actually needs or also thrives on this kind of a possibility to point the finger at these extreme creatures who simply deny it or who come up with all these kind of some really crazy conspiracy theories and so on. So that there is this kind of a very, very bad and catastrophic pas de deux dance between disavowal and denial going on, but they're both bad and they're both worse, as I guess Stalin would put it. So it's at the same time, it comes very handy when people who base their business on disavowal and pretend to be very enlightened and know everything about climate change and so on, but nevertheless continue with their business, that they have these other crazy people to point at and say, okay, look at them, we are protecting you from them, but protecting them in what sense? I mean, so there is this one thing, and the other point, I guess, was that if you look, that in a way, these weird conspiracy theories and these very sometimes crazy stories that they come up with and which are part of denial, that actually they are the embodiment of the unconscious of the very elites that are based on disavowal. You know, that actually this is precisely what they in fact believe, but although they claim that they know better than to believe this, so there is this interesting, I guess, complicity or dialectics that exists between the two. But there are many other things that could be said about the whole tense here.
You write that we respond to these strange times in two ways that are more closely related than they appear, with a massive derealization of reality and with an intense realization, a reification of certain fictions. Yeah, I wonder if you can speak to that derealization of reality and then the way that we reify certain fictions.
Yeah, I really think this is what is going on. I mean, on the one hand, you know, that there is sometimes we hear this kind of reproach even, that it is actually this whatever postmodern philosophy with all its relativism and the construction and so on, and claiming that there is no original, there is just, you know, everything is just discursively created copy of copy and so on. That this is actually what is what brought or made possible at least this explosion of conspiracy theories, which are now kind of being seen or put on the same level as scientific claims, so to say. Mm-hmm. That they, you have all these kind of different ideas, so why this would be more valuable than another and so on, and this relativism, blah, blah. And then, of course, there is also this kind of Nietzschean. The idea is that this Nietzschean thesis, there is no truth, there are only interpretations, is also what paved the way for this kind of chaotic state in which we found ourselves today. Sorry for this longer digression. I made it in order to make this point that actually the fact that there are all these, this fictionalization of our reality is not simply something that came across from whatever theory, critical theory and so on, but is something that is absolutely real. I mean, if you look at the reality now, and we can see this at this very moment, in the case of the war in Gaza, it is that you have counterfeits. You can have fabrications that are literally undistinguishable from the real. So it is not simply that we philosophers dismissed originals and so no longer we are no longer able to distinguish. It is factually and like quite realistically now many people claim this, even with the most of expertise, distinguish between some things that are fictional and what is documentary, let's say. And this with IA and so on, this is more and more becoming a fact, not to mention all these things that Žižek very well interpreted and analyzed in the context of how the most brutal aspects of capital function today precisely in and through all these fictions that we have of markets and stocks and whatever. It is not that these are just fiction. This is these fictions are precisely part of the brute and brutal reality of the capital. And many of these other fictions that I mentioned before and many others are as real. And this is like not because some theorists think that we should not distinguish between the original and the copy, but because it is kind of really, really empirically, realistically became in some cases very difficult to find. So this would be the example of how actually our reality is becoming also fictionalized in the sense of this something of this kind disappearing. And then, yeah, on the other hand, you have this strange way in which many of these fictions and also many of some other just narratives kind of start to function, even if we know they are narratives, but they start to function in a way that is, yeah, completely material, let's say, in it's completely real in itself. So this goes in both ways, and it is a very difficult process, which I would further perhaps associate with something that could be termed with one term, perhaps immediacy. And this is, I don't have the time to go into this now, but Anna Korblu, who is another scholar of our, let's say, me, she's just now publishing a book with words called Immediacy. And I think there she really, really, really correctly pins down what constitutes a kind of a core problem of many different problems that we have today, this kind of crisis of mediation and of everything, anything that is a kind of make of things so a social process and then just demands the immediate reaction, the immediate in art as well as in politics, as well as in theory, you know, you just be concrete or do away with that abstraction, you go for it, this kind of, and I think this whole thing, and I really, really strongly recommend this book of hers, is very precise and interesting way in which to name the, let's say, the not simply the symptom, but the what exactly is going on here, and that this is not necessarily a good thing, that we should be able to introduce some alienation in mediation precisely if we are to keep any notion or idea of the social at all. And so anyway, but this is already a digression. Back to your question, it was about conspiracy theories and I also find this very interesting. For instance, if you look at that, I was writing before this Don't Look Up article. Actually, this was based on another study of conspiracy theories that I made earlier. If you look at these different things from, you know, flat earthers to whatever, there is no moon landing stuff and left and forth. It's very interesting how there is this figure, you know, we talk today a lot about how this Lacanian big other, who supposedly is the term of some kind of social consistency, something that guarantees that things make sense or have some kind of social value, is disappearing. It no longer, everything is like just singularizing. And conspiracy theorists, in a way, look like a kind of desperate attempt to hang on this notion of the big other, which still has control, who still have everything that happens, is part of a master plan. So there is, or makes sense, it, or at least makes sense in one way or another. But the condition now for the existence of this whatever big other who knows exactly what is going on and coordinates things and makes sense of everything, is the only way it can survive now these days is in the figure of this evil deceiving other who is deceiving us continuously, consistently, because this is precisely what they instead, they are not simply saying this other of conspiracy is evil. Yeah, it is evil, but it is also almighty. It is also someone or organization or whatever that has absolute control over everything, that knows exactly what it is doing, why it is doing it, and employs all these forces to just produce this whatever kind of illusion it wants to produce or to keep us in. And this is very interesting because this is a very strong notion of the big other, completely consistent, but at the price of it being evil. So, and I detect here a kind of further paradox, you know, that it is as if in this way we, like, if I include myself among the conspiracies, we would not only we, in this way, we can hang on to this idea of there is some master plan, even if it's against us, even if it's evil, but there is at least a meaning of it all. But there is another more existential issue at stake here, namely that this evil other, deceiving other, is also the only perhaps and ultimate proof of my existence. Mm-hmm. Because the way this comes across is that this other is obsessed with me, like just does, keeps, passes its time trying to manipulate with me, use me, exploit me, deceive me, and so on. So there is this kind of perverse version of this Cartesian argument, you know, which goes like this. As far as this other, all my thoughts could be wrong. I'm deceived about everything that I think about, but these are still my thoughts, so I exist. And there is this version of this here, which is this, okay, perhaps this other is deceiving me, but this is the proof that I exist. I'm still here. It is obsessed with me. So, and it, for me, it's really interesting to see how this plays out very often at some kind of existential edge, precisely, where it is, if this figure would disappear, then also it would become questionable whether I exist at all. And this is then related to this other paradox of conspiracy theories, namely that they don't want to their theories to be proven correct, you know, because the moment that that some conspiracy theory would become generally recognized as truth, what would disappear is precisely this omnipotent deceiving other. It would come out that this other is not deceiving all the time, that is not omnipotent. If it was possible to break through this lie or through this illusion, so if we want, so this is what makes these dialectics all the more interesting and intriguing. So the, for instance, I don't know, I use this example also, you know, if let's say that if now somebody would discover that, in fact, moon landing was a complete scam. It never happened. I don't think that these people who are advocating this theory would be celebrating and opening champagne and whatever. No, they would simply move to another conspiracy theory. Because, and they would immediately include this into some higher, okay, but this revelation or this acceptance of this truth is actually part of a higher deception. They want to, so the game is that this deception should never be, we can expose it, but it never should be exposed to self-reflexively. It never should be inscribed into this big other that we are exposing. Because the moment this happens, the whole edifice crumbles and our existence and the proof of our existence with it.
As you were saying that last bit, it came to mind the recent Congress hearings about the existence of aliens. And the response here largely has been lack of interest. I mean, for myself too, I can't really understand why I'm no longer interested in the prospect of the existence of aliens, where before it was, it's very much the U.S. government knows and they're hiding it from everyone. And then suddenly the U.S. government is saying, well, actually the aliens might exist. So that it, and then like you were just saying, it moves on to say, okay, why are they telling us this? What's the greater conspiracy occurring?
Yeah,
I know, because I mean, the whole idea, if you really listen, I mean, I've listened to some of these testimonies, you can find them online. There is also this Netflix documentary Behind the Curve, which is kind of interesting. You get lots of direct testimonies. You immediately realize that the whole thing, for instance, let's take the flat earth or the moon landing, it's not about whether it really happened or not. It is about whether or not they are manipulating us. They are. So it's all about, I mean, the facts that are being presented or disputed are secondary. What is, they are just like a means of one way of telling this narrative about the crucial thing, which is that there is this mega deception, manipulation going on, conducted by them. This them is very they, them, and so on. It's a word kind of signifier that keeps popping up. And of course, we cannot say that there, this is also one of my points, conspiracies exist. I'm not saying there are things, and also that are proven, and that they are not just imagination of people. Some things that there are, let's say, conspiracies. But the point that, or the distinction that I would make between some suspicions about certain conspiracies coming, becoming true or being proven as true, and this passion for conspiracy theory in whatever form of shape, the difference is not simply, through fact or no fact, but it's more like, this famous Lacanian saying that even if a jealous, let's say you have a jealous husband who keeps accusing his wife of cheating on him, and his point is that even if in fact the wife does cheat on him, jealousy as such is still pathological. There is still a kind of surplus investment in this jealousy and the way it organizes the whole universe for you, which cannot be explained away or saying, okay, now if she really did cheat on him, so there is no jealousy is still pathological. And I think here it's this kind of delicate or not so delicate, but nevertheless margin, edge on which we move when we deal with all kinds of these conspirational ideas. They want us to do this or that, or that there is often an element of truth in something, but and it's also true that we are generally speaking being manipulated most of the time. It's not actually that this is a not at all, it's just paranoia. But then how we deal with this, how and what does it mean for us, to what extent we base the meaning of our existence on the meaning of this and make it dependent on it. And here it's precisely when we fortify the very thing, because again, to return to the movie, Don't Look Up, I think this is a point that I also make in this commentary. It's not simply that these elites, or whatever usually are the part of conspiracy theory narratives. The elites, they know exactly what they're doing, and they're trying to navigate us towards some whatever catastrophe that would present a gain for them. No, the problem is that they are elites. Clearly, there are elites. They are doing nasty things. But the bottom line is that, no, they don't know exactly what they are doing. It's worse. And this is the point. It's not that there are no forces that we don't know and that kind of conspire more or less or just coincide in some kind of interest that then looks as this was orchestrated in whatever other way. The point is precisely, no, if you say, these rich people, they cannot be so stupid as not to really believe the climate change if in fact there was one. But this is the mistake that we make and say, no, they are so stupid. No, they disavow it not because, I mean, the fact that they're educated or rich does not exempt them from this kind of possible error or whatever, even something more dramatic. But this is precisely, there is a conspiracy, only there is no super agent of this conspiracy that would but if we claim there is, we precisely prevent ourselves, block ourselves from entering seriously or trying to interfere seriously into these processes that are going on, and just kind of seal the whole story in a more or less permanent way.
Yeah, we see that a lot. I mean, more and more it seems like the elites have their own sets of conspiracy theories and use like accusations of conspiracies to dismiss, you know, things quite easily. Like, it's just enough to call something a conspiracy. How do we navigate that versus, like you were saying, in terms of like ideological critique, trying to understand our situation?
Precisely by not simply saying all the things that I was trying to say just now are part of this navigating. It is true. I mean, we have to look at things, analyze them, not necessarily take them at their face value, but at the same time, not trying to think that the truth is actually always behind and always other than the one that is officially presented. Very much, very often, the truth is quite on the surface. You don't need to dig very deep in order to get or reveal it or whatever. But you have to be able to read the surface, to recognize the symptoms, and also to recognize the points when this other, as evil and as corrupted as it is precisely not omnipotent. It is not, it has its own inconsistencies, it has its own impasses, and these are the points which we need to kind of attack. But if you believe that this is just some perfectly consistent plan which is faultless, I mean, obviously it's difficult because the asymmetry of power is usually very striking. But as you say, the very fact that also these elites need their own conspiracy theorists in order to survive these contradictions that they're like ridden with, it's also something. Involving oneself in the process of thinking about these things is already quite something. I mean, it's not just some useless intellectual exercise, but it actually has and can have social implications, particularly if many people start to think about it seriously and precisely not fall so easily as we are now kind of supposed to and trained to fall so easily and react immediately on this kind of triggers from left and from the right. That, you know, we are really bombarded with this kind of atmosphere where there are these flags all around us and people waving them. And you are supposed, if you are on the left, you're supposed to react to this flag. If you are on the right, you're supposed to, and then scream very loudly so that people in your camp will recognize and certificate your conformity to their side. And this is all this is really crazy because it has nothing to do with social reality, only with this kind of checking the right box or trying to prove that you are, you know, on the right, whatever side of this or that, or but it has nothing to do with the real questions in the sense of, how to break out of this, I don't know. It's difficult and it's very always very controversial because the moment, and you know that this happens a lot to Slava, precisely to Žižek, that if he says something that is slightly out of tune, let's say with certain doxa on the left, then he's immediately dismissed as the proto-fascist, right? I mean,
much more so than on the right. Like people,
I'm not saying that one needs to necessarily agree with everything, but still, there are precisely these kind of things are most interesting where this kind of consensus needs to be questioned and re-questioned. This is how we move also socially, because social tissue is moving and changing, and it's not. And there, again, as Slavoj keeps repeating, this kind of really strange, unholy alliances going on. You know, one of his examples is precisely, I think it's Congo, where, you know, they passed now this most terrible law against homosexuality and any kind of non-traditional sexual behavior, like death punishment, or I don't know. But at the same time, they are presenting this as their struggle against colonialism, you know, because all this LGBT thing is supposed to be part of the American colonialist whatever ideology. So you just declare yourself to be against LGBT, gays, whatever, and say that this is your profound anti-colonial struggle. So what do you do with this? How do you break these things apart? And how you try to construct some really meaningful alliances, not just alliances made on these strange, you know, these words, colonialism, anti-colonialism, this, right? I don't know. It's difficult, and I think this will need to be, this work will need to be taken up, and the world also of thinking about this thing and not simply reacting, as I said earlier, immediately when you see this or that word appear. Try to think it in the context. What does it mean? And are your alliances really with this, or perhaps not so much, even though on the surface one would say, yeah. So I guess, the world is going through a quite dramatic, I would say, change, where also some of these words are becoming meaningless or only have meaning within certain things, or referring to something that are no longer really there in this way, in this sense.
Mm. Yeah, because part of the difficulty that you've outlined is that knowledge can function as a fetish, and there is this intensification of enjoyment with knowledge itself. But at the same time, it's how we're positioned in relation to that knowledge, how that knowledge gets mobilized. The difficulty with something like conspiracy theory is what kind of cognitive mapping we have to relate to, how to relate to information, how to organize it. Given there's this subject to deceive, as you say, with conspiracy theory.
I agree that this is absolutely a crucial question, and actually, another member of the Slovene school, Mladen Dular, has this very interesting text or whatever, I think it was, or it was an interview, precisely where he very nicely explains the difference between knowledge and information, which because it's not exactly that we have lots of information, like this incredible mass of information, but this information is precisely not knowledge. It is simply, it has a very, very different structure. And I guess the problem is, so the already knowledge itself is something different than information. It involves a certain not only processing of this information, but also assuming a certain relation to it, also kind of perhaps selecting this information, verifying in this or that way. I mean, it is a whole process again of mediating this immediacy of information and facts. So because information is something immediate. Immediately you can, now I can Google and I have like immediate access to much more information that I can reasonably process. But then, and I keep hearing this also from the part of journalists and so on, there is no longer even time to process this for them to kind of, because usually newspaper articles are also supposed to be journalist articles, something else than just passing on the same information. It is about a certain knowledge that gives you the capacity to articulate this information, to make certain sense of it in a way, or to precisely explain something, which, because information is always has all these kind of different sides to it, and you have to process it, you have to make it part of some kind of reflective or whatever movement which goes beyond this. But this is becoming intrinsically difficult once, because of the tempo in which we find ourselves, that everything, also the information is old in before you can even start processing it, it's already new information is on the table. So there is this kind of a urgency of just taking in, which would allow no time for something like, let's say, knowledge in this sense coming out of it, or at least starting to shape out of it. So this is definitely a big problem, which also to some extent relates to this imperative of immediacy and to this ideology that what you see is real. I mean, like the information, which is, no, this is just, it's so much foam. It's even, you see people dying, but even that, there is no real for us in this anymore. And this is really what is terrible. And I also think that, what we say, so that there are the post-factual world or whatever, there are no facts anymore. You could also say that there are only facts, only there is no way to distinguishing between them, to have any kind of hierarchy or distinction of which of them does touch or does import some real and which does not. And so this is definitely a real problem. But the other thing that you started your question with, namely, fetishization of knowledge. Actually, I talk about this in a more specific sense, not simply in the sense that knowledge is now becoming kind of fetishized in the sense of we like knowledge so much, because I really think we don't. I mean, we say it's important, but we don't really think it's so important to have knowledge. But I was referring to this motion, to this movement involved in the mechanism of disavowal that I described before, namely that not only you say I know well, but nevertheless, you kind of additionally make out of this knowledge, this first part, I know well, the very fetish that by displaying this fetish, it makes it possible for you to go on as before. So what I'm saying is that we no longer simply have this kind of opposition. I know well, but nevertheless, I go on as if I didn't know. Now I think we are dealing with something like, I know very well, and this is precisely why I can go on as if I didn't know. Declaring this knowledge, saying, waving with it, like with the fetish, enables me to say, okay, look, no, I know all this. So you need, it's not simply the opposition or this, but it's actually you knowledge objectified in a way that is completely detaches it from any kind of implications or meaning or whatever, but allows you precisely to ignore everything that this knowledge conveys or articulates.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons why self-help books are so popular, because you get to have a book that contains all the knowledge. You read it, it's there, and it functions for you. You don't have to actually take any of it on or whatever, right? I like this idea, thinking about the performative speech acts, like I declare this session opened. There was something funny. There was a Zizek lecture where he just begins by saying, in conclusion, and then just goes on his speech. So in that mode, in conclusion, your work on the end, we had an episode on it, and it's a very difficult idea to wrap your head around, this idea like the postponement of the end. So I think it was The End of Ideology, The Ideology of the End, one of those essays that you wrote. But this idea that there's a kind of asymptotic approach to the end, but there's this postponement where you're forever caught in this prolongation between this position and the end. So what is it that sustains that movement, and how are we supposed to think about getting out of that deadlock?
Yeah, I mean, one very simple way, too simple probably or too abstract, is precisely to say, to declare that the end has already taken place. I mean, we are already on the other side of it. And I think, to some extent, I think this is how we should be thinking about things, precisely as climate change and so on, which are very often phrased in terms of this, how much time we still have left before we reach the point where it will actually become completely irreversible. In a way, we know that it already has become irreversible. And we just not mean that now we just can raise our hands and say, okay, we can no longer, we should really move out of this space and realize that we are now situated, or that we find ourselves in a very different space, of which we still have to figure out laws and tempos and whatever. But this is really difficult, because this image of approaching the end of something that we can or still avoid or not is so captivating, and it's precisely what definitely keeps us attached to a world that actually no longer even exists. You know, it's really kind of almost comical. It could have some kind of images from, I don't know, Tom and Jerry cartoons, when they're, you know, it's already, you are already far marching on without any soil beneath you, but still you do it, you know, and then the moment you look down, you fall. But okay, you fall, but then another logic starts, and you try to navigate this fall, and not just managing the damage, but also trying to think out of different parameters, because I think this is also obviously one of the problems, and again part of this immediacy ideology, which is that this kind of complete almost lack of imagination, which confines us to what is here and what is given. You know, it is crazy. We cannot, okay, we have all these catchphrases like think outside of the box. I don't know what exactly this means, but in a way, we really are, the more we advance in all this technology and IA, whatever, but the more this kind of a mediatic imagination also in politics and whatever is being narrowed down to minimal or disappeared in this immediacy of responding that we are demand to undertake. But this actually confines us and makes it only possible for us to choose among the possibilities that exist now at this moment, you know. And this is always a problem if you just limit. I mean, not that you can. I'm not saying you have to now use imagination and imagine, I don't know what science fiction scenario, but the problem is the problems that we have are related to the things that determine the possibility, the set of possibilities for us. And if we remain with this set of possibilities, just then we are fucked. It's just not, because it's clearly then there is all this blackmail going on. Yeah, but if you did this, then you will. So there is something that, what is needed is to break or to just simply follow things, even if they seem illogical or impossible at that time, that may perhaps introduce another set of possibilities or another possibility and not simply immediately like shutting, really narrowing down with all the development and globalization. But I think our space of thinking and of acting is really getting more and more reduced to some kind of a claustrophobic minimum, in spite of allegedly infinite possibilities that we have to explore our lives. But in this kind of fundamental sense, it is really narrowing down. And I don't know. I can talk about this, but I don't have a magic formula to say, okay, now, we talk about all these problems, but
Maybe on the next episode, you can think about it and come back with a magic formula. Alenka, I think we maybe can let you go now. Is there anything? Yeah, I think we had a little plug for your next book. Is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners who can look forward to any publications or anything like that?
No, this is the next one, and then I'm sure we'll meet in some way or another before the next one comes out. I don't write so quickly, so I know that the next project is more focused on. I would like to introduce the and re-examine the whole notion of desire and how it relates to enjoyment. And this is something that I started to tackle a little bit in the Antigone book, you know, this other small book that I recently published. But I'm now returning to this through different questions, from Afro-pessimism to that. There is something about this notion of desire that I think was dismissed too quickly or lost its appeal vis-a-vis these questions of drive and jouissance and so on, and which I think is also of interest and could be of explosive kind of interest precisely again in this present configuration of the social, of thinking and so on. So this is the next project that I have to re-enter this issue of desire with all its difficulties as something that has an intrinsic, nevertheless, emancipatory potential, which is not simply reducible to this kind of proverbial, you know, hysterical desire who only wants to change nothing so that it could complain or whatever. I think there is also something about hysteria which is much more interesting than this. But anyway, this will be for the after the next book, although I already have some bits of it written. But yeah.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. It was really great talking to you.
Thank you all. I also enjoyed this a lot.
Yeah, hope to speak again.
Thank you.
Great day.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Alenka.
Intro one. And so on. Thank you.